21. General Dreidel. Colonel Cathcart was not thinking anything at all about the chaplain, but was tangled up in a brand new menacing problem of his own. Yossarian. The mere sound of that execrable, ugly name made his blood run cold and his breath come in labored gasps. The chaplain's first mention of the name Yossarian had tolled deep in his memory like a portentous gong. As soon as the latch of the door had clicked shut, the whole humiliating recollection of the naked man in formation came cascading down upon him in a mortifying, choking flood of stinging details. He began to perspire and tremble. There was a sinister and unlikely coincidence exposed that was too diabolical in implication to be anything less than the most hideous of omens. The name of the man who had stood naked in ranks that day to receive his distinguished flying cross from General Dreidel had also been Yossarian. And now it was a man named Yossarian who was threatening to make trouble over the 60 missions he had just ordered the men in his group to fly. Colonel Cathcart wondered gloomily if it was the same Yossarian. He climbed to his feet with an air of intolerable woe and began moving about his office. He felt himself in the presence of the mysterious. The naked man in formation, he conceded cheerlessly, had been a real black eye for him. So had the tampering with the bomb line before the mission to Bologna and the 7-day delay in destroying the bridge at Ferrara, even though destroying the bridge at Ferrara finally, he remembered with glee, had been a real feather in his cap, although losing a plane there the second time around, he recalled in dejection, had been another black eye, even though he had won another real feather in his cap by getting a medal approved for the bombardier who had gotten him the real black eye in the first place by going around over the target twice. That bombardier's name, he remembered suddenly with another stupefying shock, had also been Yossarian. Now there were three. His viscous eyes bulged with astonishment, and he whipped himself around in alarm to see what was taking place behind him. A moment ago, there had been no Yossarians in his life. Now they were multiplying like hobgoblins. He tried to make himself grow calm. Yossarian was not a common name. Perhaps there were not really three Yossarians, but only two Yossarians, or maybe even only one Yossarian. But that really made no difference. The colonel was still in grave peril. Intuition warned him that he was drawing close to some immense and inscrutable cosmic climax, and his broad, meaty, towering frame tingled from head to toe at the thought that Yossarian, whoever he would eventually turn out to be, was destined to serve as his nemesis. Colonel Cathcart was not superstitious, but he did believe in omens, and he sat right back down behind his desk and made a cryptic notation on his memorandum pad to look into the whole suspicious business of the Yossarians right away. He wrote his reminder to himself in a heavy and decisive hand, amplifying it sharply with a series of coded punctuation marks and underlining the whole message twice so that it read, Yossarian! The colonel sat back when he had finished and was extremely pleased with himself for the prompt action he had just taken to meet this sinister crisis. Yossarian! The very sight of the name made him shudder. There were so many S's in it. It just had to be subversive. It was like the word subversive itself. It was like seditious and insidious, too, and like socialist, suspicious, fascist, and communist. It was an odious, alien, distasteful name, a name that just did not inspire confidence. It was not at all like such clean, crisp, honest American names as Cathcart, Peckham, and Dreidel. Colonel Cathcart rose slowly and began drifting about his office again. Almost unconsciously, he picked up a plum tomato from the top of one of the bushels and took a voracious bite. He made a wry face at once and threw the rest of the plum tomato into his wastebasket. The colonel did not like plum tomatoes. not even when they were his own. And these were not even his own. These had been purchased in different marketplaces all over Pianosa by Colonel Korn under various identities, moved up to the colonel's farmhouse in the hills in the dead of night, and transported down to group headquarters the next morning for sale to Milo, who paid Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn premium prices for them. Colonel Cathcart often wondered if what they were doing with the plum tomatoes was legal, but Colonel Korn said it was, and he tried not to brood about it too often. He had no way of knowing whether or not the house in the hills was legal either, since Colonel Korn had made all the arrangements. Colonel Cathcart did not know if he owned the house or rented it, from whom he had acquired it, or how much, if anything, it was costing. Colonel Korn was the lawyer, and if Colonel Korn assured him that fraud, extortion, currency manipulation, embezzlement, income tax evasion, and black market speculations were legal, Colonel Cathcart was in no position to disagree with him. All Colonel Cathcart knew about his house in the hills was that he had such a house and hated it. He was never so bored as when spending there the 2 or 3 days every other week necessary to sustain the illusion that his damp and drafty stone farmhouse in the hills was a golden palace of carnal delights. Officers' clubs everywhere pulsated with blurred but knowing accounts of lavish, hushed-up drinking and sex orgies there, and of secret, intimate nights of ecstasy with the most beautiful, the most tantalizing, the most readily aroused, and most easily satisfied Italian courtesans, film actresses, models, and countesses. No such private nights of ecstasy or hushed-up drinking and sex orgies ever occurred. They might have occurred if either General Dreidel or General Peckham had once evinced an interest in taking part in orgies with him, but neither ever did, and the colonel was certainly not going to waste his time and energy making love to beautiful women unless there was something in it for him. The colonel dreaded his dank, lonely nights at his farmhouse and the dull, uneventful days. He had much more fun back at group, browbeating everyone he wasn't afraid of. However, as Colonel Korn kept reminding him, there was not much glamour in having a farmhouse in the hills if he never used it. He drove off to his farmhouse each time in a mood of self-pity. He carried a shotgun in his jeep and spent the monotonous hours there shooting at it birds and at the plum tomatoes that did grow there in untended rows and were too much trouble to harvest. Among those officers of inferior rank toward whom Colonel Cathcart still deemed it prudent to show respect, he included Major de Coverley, even though he did not want to, and was not sure he even had to. Major de Coverley was as great a mystery to him as he was to Major and to everyone else who ever took notice of him. Colonel Cathcart had no idea whether to look up or look down in his attitude toward Major de Coverley. Major de Coverley was only a major, even though he was ages older than Colonel Cathcart. At the same time, so many other people treated Major de Coverley with such profound and fearful veneration that Colonel Cathcart had a hunch they might all know something. Major de Coverley was an ominous, incomprehensible presence who kept him constantly on edge, and of whom even Colonel Korn tended to be wary. Everyone was afraid of him, and no one knew why. No one even knew Major de Coverley's first name, because no one had ever had the temerity to ask him. Colonel Cathcart knew that Major de Coverley was away, and he rejoiced in his absence until it occurred to him that Major de Coverley might be away somewhere conspiring against him. And then he wished that Major de Coverley were back in his squadron where he belonged, so that he could be watched. In a little while, Colonel Cathcart's arches began to ache from pacing back and forth so much. He sat down behind his desk again and resolved to embark upon a mature and systematic evaluation of the entire military situation. With the businesslike air of a man who knows how to get things done, he found a large white pad, drew a straight line down the middle, and crossed it near the top, dividing the page into two blank columns of equal width. He rested a moment in critical rumination. Then he huddled over his desk, and at the head of the left column, in a cramped and finicky hand, he wrote, "Black eyes." At the top of the right column, he wrote, "Feathers in my cap." He leaned back once more to inspect his chart admiringly from an objective perspective. After a few seconds of solemn deliberation, he licked the tip of his pencil carefully and wrote under black eyes, after intent intervals, "Ferrara, Bologna, bomb line moved on map during, Skeet range, naked man in formation, after Avignon." Then he added, "Food poisoning, during Bologna, and moaning, epidemic of during Avignon briefing." Then he added, "Chaplain, banging around officers' club every night." He decided to be charitable about the chaplain, even though he did not like him, and under "feathers in my cap," he wrote, "Chaplain, hanging around officers' club every night." The two chaplain entries therefore neutralized each other. Alongside "Ferrara" and "naked man in formation," after Avignon, he then wrote, "Yossarian." Alongside "Bologna, bomb line moved on map during, food poisoning during Bologna, and moaning, epidemic of during Avignon briefing," he wrote in a bold, decisive hand, "?" Those entries labeled ?" were the ones he wanted to investigate immediately to determine if Yossarian had played any part in them. Suddenly his arm began to shake, and he was unable to write anymore. He rose to his feet in terror, feeling sticky and fat, and rushed to the open window to gulp in fresh air. His gaze fell on the skeet range, and he reeled away with a sharp cry of distress, his wild and feverish eyes scanning the walls of his office frantically, as though they were swarming with Yossarians. Nobody loved him. General Dreidel hated him, although General Peckham liked him. Although he couldn't be sure, since Colonel Cargill, General Peckham's aide, undoubtedly had ambitions of his own and was probably sabotaging him with General Peckham at every opportunity. The only good colonel, he decided, was a dead colonel, except for himself. The only colonel he trusted was Colonel Moodus, and even he had an in with his father-in-law. Milo, of course, had been the big feather in his cap, although having his group bombed by Milo's planes had probably been a terrible black eye for him, even though Milo had ultimately stilled all protest in disclosing the huge net profit the syndicate had realized on the deal with the enemy, and convincing everyone that bombing his own men and planes had therefore really been a commendable and very lucrative blow on the side of private enterprise. The colonel was insecure about Milo because other colonels were trying to lure him away, and Colonel Cathcart still had that lousy big chief white half-oat in his group, who that lousy, lazy Captain Black claimed was the one really responsible for the bomb lines being moved during the big siege of Bologna. Colonel Cathcart liked Big Chief White Half-Oat, because Big Chief White Half-Oat kept punching that lousy Colonel Moodus in the nose every time he got drunk and Colonel Moodus was around. He wished that Big Chief White Half-Oat would begin punching Colonel Korn in his fat face, too. Colonel Korn was a lousy smart aleck. Someone at 27th Air Force Headquarters had it in for him and sent back every report he wrote with a blistering rebuke. And Colonel Korn had bribed a clever mail clerk there named Wintergreen to try to find out who it was. Losing that plane over Ferrara the second time around had not done him any good, he had to admit, and neither had having that other plane disappear inside that cloud. That was one he hadn't even written down. He tried to recall longingly if Yossarian had been lost in that plane in the cloud, and realized that Yossarian could not possibly have been lost in that plane in the cloud if he was still around now, raising such a big stink about having to fly a lousy 5 missions more. Maybe 60 missions were too many for the men to fly, Colonel Cathcart reasoned, if Yossarian objected to flying them. But he then remembered that forcing his men to fly more missions than everyone else was the most tangible achievement he had going for him. As Colonel Korn often remarked, the war was crawling with group commanders who were merely doing their duty, and it required just some sort of dramatic gesture like making his group fly more combat missions than any other bomber group to spotlight his unique qualities of leadership. Certainly none of the generals seemed to object to what he was doing, although as far as he could detect, they weren't particularly impressed either, which made him suspect that perhaps 60 combat missions were not nearly enough, and that he ought to increase the number at once to 70, 80, 100, or even 200, 300, or 6,000. Certainly he would be much better off under somebody suave like General Peckham than he was under somebody boorish and insensitive like General Dreidel, because General Peckham had the discernment, the intelligence, and the Ivy League background to appreciate and enjoy him at his full value, although General Peckham had never given the slightest indication that he appreciated or enjoyed him at all. Colonel Cathcart felt perceptive enough to realize that visible signals of recognition were never necessary between sophisticated, self-assured people like himself and General Peckham, who could warm to each other from a distance with innate mutual understanding. It was enough that they were of like kind, and he knew it was only a matter of waiting discreetly for preferment until the right time, although it rotted Colonel Cathcart's self-esteem to observe that General Peckham never deliberately sought him out, and that he labored no harder to impress Colonel Cathcart with his epigrams and erudition than he did to impress anyone else in earshot, even enlisted men. Either Colonel Cathcart wasn't getting through to General Peckham, or General Peckham was not the scintillating, discriminating, intellectual, forward-looking personality he pretended to be. And it was really General Dreidel who was sensitive, charming, brilliant, and sophisticated, and under whom he would certainly be much better off. And suddenly Colonel Cathcart had absolutely no conception of how strongly he stood with anyone and began banging on his buzzer with his fist for Colonel Korn to come running into his office and assure him that everybody loved him, that Yossarian was a figment of his imagination, and that he was making wonderful progress in the splendid and valiant campaign he was waging to become a general. Actually, Colonel Cathcart did not have a chance in hell of becoming a general. For one thing, there was ex-PFC Wintergreen, who also wanted to be a general, and who always distorted, destroyed, rejected, or misdirected any correspondence by, for, or about Colonel Cathcart that might do him credit. For another, there was already a general, General Dreidel, who knew that General Peckham was after his job, but did not know how to stop him. General Dreidel, the wing commander, was a blunt, chunky, barrel-chested man in his early 50s. His nose was squat and red, and he had lumpy, white, bunched-up eyelids circling his small, gray eyes like halos of bacon fat. He had a nurse and a son-in-law, and he was prone to long, ponderous silences when he had not been drinking too much. General Dreidel had wasted too much of his time in the army doing his job well, and now it was too late. New power alignments had coalesced without him, and he was at a loss to cope with them. At unguarded moments, his hard and sullen face slipped into a somber, preoccupied look of defeat and frustration. General Dreidel drank a great deal. His moods were arbitrary and unpredictable. "War is hell," he declared frequently, drunk or sober, and he really meant it, although that did not prevent him from making a good living out of it or from taking his son-in-law into the business with him, even though the two bickered constantly. "That bastard," General Dreidel would complain about his son-in-law with a contemptuous grunt to anyone who happened to be standing beside him at the curve of the bar of the officers' club. "Everything he's got, he owes to me. I made him, that lousy son of a bitch. He hasn't got brains enough to get ahead on his own."
"He thinks he knows everything," Colonel Moodus would retort in a sulking tone to his own audience at the other end of the bar. He can't take criticism and he won't listen to advice.
All he can do is give advice, General Dreidel would observe with a rasping snort. If it wasn't for me, he'd still be a corporal.
General Dreidel was always accompanied by both Colonel Moodus and his nurse, who was as delectable a piece of ass as anyone who saw her had ever laid eyes on. General Dreidel's nurse was chubby, short, and blonde. She had plump, dimpled cheeks, happy blue eyes, and neat, curly, turned-up hair. She smiled at everyone and never spoke at all unless she was spoken to. Her bosom was lush and her complexion clear. She was irresistible, and men edged away from her carefully. She was succulent, sweet, docile, and dumb, and she drove everyone crazy but General Dreidel.
You should see her naked, General Dreidel chortled with croupy relish, while his nurse stood smiling proudly right at his shoulder. Back in wing, she's got a uniform in my room made of purple silk that's so tight her nipples stand out like Bing cherries. Milo got me the fabric. There isn't even room enough for panties or a brassiere underneath. I make her wear it some nights when Moodus is around just to drive him crazy.
General Dreidel laughed hoarsely.
You should see what goes on inside that blouse of hers every time she shifts her weight. She drives him out of his mind. The first time I catch him putting a hand on her or any other woman, I'll bust the horny bastard right down to private and put him on KP for a year.
He keeps around just to drive me crazy, Colonel Moodus accused aggrievedly at the other end of the bar. Back at wing, she's got a uniform made out of purple silk that's so tight her nipples stand out like Bing cherries. There isn't even room for panties or a brassiere underneath. You should hear that silk rustle every time she shifts her weight. First time I make a pass at her or any other girl, he'll bust me right down to private and put me on KP for a year. She drives me out of my mind.
He hasn't gotten laid since we shipped overseas, confided General Dreidel, and his square, grizzled head bobbed with sadistic laughter at the fiendish idea. That's one of the reasons I never let him out of my sight, just so he can't get to a woman. Can you imagine what that poor son of a bitch is going through?
I haven't been to bed with a woman since we shipped overseas, Colonel Moodus whimpered tearfully. Can you imagine what I'm going through?
General Dreidel could be as intransigent with anyone else when displeased as he was with Colonel Moodus. He had no taste for sham, tact, or pretension, and his credo as a professional soldier was unified and concise. He believed that the young men who took orders from him should be willing to give up their lives for the ideals, aspirations, and idiosyncrasies of the old men he took orders from. The officers and enlisted men in his command had identity for him only as military quantities. All he asked was that they do their work. Beyond that, they were free to do whatever they pleased. They were free, as Colonel Cathcart was free, to force their men to fly 60 missions if they chose, and they were free, as Yossarian had been free, to stand in formation naked if they wanted to. Although General Dreidel's granite jaw swung open at the sight, and he went striding dictatorially right down the line to make certain that there really was a man wearing nothing but moccasins waiting at attention in ranks to receive a medal from him. General Dreidel was speechless. Colonel Cathcart began to faint when he spied Yossarian, and Colonel Korn stepped up behind him and squeezed his arm in a strong grip. The silence was grotesque. A steady warm wind flowed in from the beach. An old cart filled with dirty straw rumbled into view on the main road, drawn by a black donkey and driven by a farmer in a flopping hat and faded brown work clothes, who paid no attention to the formal military ceremony taking place in the small field on his right. At last, General Dreidel spoke.
"Get back in the car," he snapped over his shoulder to his nurse who had followed him down the line.
The nurse toddled away with a smile toward his brown staff car, parked about 20 yards away at the edge of the rectangular clearing. General Dreidel waited in austere silence until the car door slammed, and then demanded,
"Which one is this?"
Colonel Mudis checked his roster.
This one is Yossarian, Dad. He gets a distinguished flying cross.
"Well, I'll be damned," mumbled General Dreidel, and his ruddy, monolithic face softened with amusement. "Why aren't you wearing clothes, Yossarian?"
"I don't want to."
"What do you mean you don't want to? Why the hell don't you want to?"
"I just don't want to, sir."
"Why isn't he wearing clothes?"
General Dreidel demanded over his shoulder of Colonel Cathcart.
"He's talking to you,"
Colonel Korn whispered over Colonel Cathcart's shoulder from behind, jabbing his elbow sharply into Colonel Cathcart's back.
"Why isn't he wearing clothes?"
Colonel Cathcart demanded of Colonel Korn with a look of acute pain, tenderly nursing the spot where Colonel Korn had just jabbed him.
"Why isn't he wearing clothes?"
Colonel Korn demanded of Captain Pilchard and Captain Wren.
"A man was killed in his plane over Avignon last week and bled all over him,"
Captain Wren replied.
"He swears he's never going to wear a uniform again." "A man was killed in his plane over Avignon last week and bled all over him," Captain Korn reported directly to General Dreidel. "His uniform hasn't come back from the laundry yet."
"Where are his other uniforms?"
"They're in the laundry, too."
"What about his underwear?"
General Dreidel demanded.
"All his underwear is in the laundry, too," answered Colonel Korn.
"That sounds like a lot of crap to me,"
General Dreidel declared.
"It is a lot of crap, sir,"
Yossarian said.
"Don't you worry, sir,"
Colonel Cathcart promised General Dreidel with a threatening look at Yossarian.
"You have my personal word for it that this man will be severely punished."
"What the hell do I care if he's punished or not?"
General Dreidel replied with surprise and irritation.
"He's just won a medal. If he wants to receive it without any clothes on, what the hell business is it of yours?"
"Those are my sentiments exactly, sir,"
Colonel Cathcart echoed with resounding enthusiasm and mopped his brow with a damp white handkerchief.
"But would you say that, sir, even in the light of General Peckham's recent memorandum on the subject of appropriate military attire in combat areas?"
"Peckham?"
General Dreidel's face clouded.
"Yes, sir,
said Colonel Cathcart obsequiously.
"General Peckham even recommends that we send our men into combat in full dress uniform so they'll make a good impression on the enemy when they're shot down."
"Peckham?"
repeated General Dreidel, still squinting with bewilderment.
"Just what the hell does Peckham have to do with it?"
Colonel Korn jabbed Colonel Cathcart sharply again in the back with his elbow.
"Absolutely nothing, sir,"
Colonel Cathcart responded sprucely, wincing in extreme pain and gingerly rubbing the spot where Colonel Korn had just jabbed him again.
"And that's exactly why I decided to take absolutely no action at all until I first had an opportunity to discuss it with you. Shall we ignore it completely, sir?"
General Dreidel ignored him completely, turning away from him in baleful scorn to hand Yossarian his medal in its case.
"Get my girl back from the car,"
he commanded Colonel Mudis crabbily, and waited in one spot with his scowling face down until his nurse had rejoined him.
"Get word to the office right away to kill that directive I just issued ordering the men to wear neckties on the combat missions,"
Colonel Cathcart whispered to Colonel Korn urgently out of the corner of his mouth.
"I told you not to do it," Colonel Korn snickered, "but you just wouldn't listen to me."
"Shh," Colonel Cathcart cautioned. "God damn it, Korn! What did you do to my back?"
Colonel Korn snickered again. General Dreidel's nurse always followed General Dreidel everywhere he went, even into the briefing room just before the mission to Avignon, where she stood with her asinine smile at the side of the platform and bloomed like a fertile oasis at General Dreidel's shoulder in her pink and green uniform. Yossarian looked at her and fell in love, desperately. His spirits sank, leaving him empty inside and numb. He sat gazing in clammy want at her full red lips and dimpled cheeks as he listened to Major Danby describe in a monotonous didactic male drone the heavy concentrations of flak awaiting them at Avignon, and he moaned in deep despair suddenly at the thought that he might never see again this lovely woman to whom he had never spoken a word and whom he now loved so pathetically. He throbbed and ached with sorrow, fear, and desire as he stared at her. She was so beautiful. He worshipped the ground she stood on. He licked his parched, thirsting lips with a sticky tongue and moaned in misery again, loudly enough this time to attract the startled, searching glances of the men sitting around him on the rows of crude wooden benches in their chocolate-colored coveralls and stitched white parachute harnesses. Nately turned to him quickly with alarm.
"What is it?" he whispered. "What's the matter?"
Yossarian did not hear him. He was sick with lust and mesmerized with regret. General Dreidel's nurse was only a little chubby, and his senses were stuffed to congestion with the yellow radiance of her hair and the unfelt pressure of her soft, short fingers, with the rounded, untasted wealth of her nubile breasts in her army pink shirt that was opened wide at the throat, and with the rolling, ripened, triangular confluences of her belly and thighs in her tight, slick, forest-green gabardine officer's pants. He drank her in insatiably from head to painted toenail. He never wanted to lose her.
Oh,
he moaned again, and this time the whole room rippled at his quavering, drawn-out cry. A wave of startled uneasiness broke over the officers on the dais, and even Major Danby, who had begun synchronizing the watches, was distracted momentarily as he counted out the seconds and almost had to begin again. Nately followed Yossarian's transfixed gaze down the long frame auditorium until he came to General Dreidel's nurse. He blanched with trepidation when he guessed what was troubling Yossarian.
"Cut it out, will you?"
Nately warned in a fierce whisper.
Oh,
Yossarian moaned a fourth time, this time loudly enough for everyone to hear him distinctly.
"Are you crazy?"
Nately hissed vehemently.
"You'll get into trouble."
Oh,
Dunbar answered Yossarian from the opposite end of the room. Nately recognized Dunbar's voice. The situation was now out of control, and he turned away with a small moan.
Oh,
Dunbar moaned back at him.
Oh,
Nately moaned out loud in exasperation when he realized he had just moaned.
Oh,
Dunbar moaned back at him again.
Oh,
someone entirely new chimed in from another section of the room, and Nately's hair stood on end. Yossarian and Dunbar both replied, while Nately cringed and hunted about futilely for some hole in which to hide and take Yossarian with him. A sprinkling of people were smothering laughter. An elfin impulse possessed Nately, and he moaned intentionally the next time there was a lull. Another new voice answered. The flavor of disobedience was titillating, and Nately moaned deliberately again the next time he could squeeze one in edgewise. Still another new voice echoed him. The room was boiling irrepressibly into bedlam. An eerie hubbub of voices was rising. Feet were scuffled, and things began to drop from people's fingers, pencils, computers, map cases, clattering steel flak helmets. A number of men who were not moaning were now giggling openly,
and there was no telling how far the unorganized insurrection of Moaning might have gone if General Dreidel himself had not come forward to quell it, stepping out determinedly in the center of the platform, directly in front of Major Danby, who, with his earnest, persevering head down, was still concentrating on his wristwatch and saying,
25 seconds, 20, 15...
General Dreidel's great red domineering face was gnarled with perplexity and oaken with awesome resolution.
"That will be all, men," he ordered tersely, his eyes glaring with disapproval and his square jaw firm,
and that's all there was.
"I run a fighting outfit," he told them sternly,
when the room had grown absolutely quiet and the men on the benches were all cowering sheepishly.
"And there'll be no more Moaning in this group, as long as I'm in command. Is that clear?"
It was clear to everybody but Major Danby, who was still concentrating on his wristwatch and counting down the seconds aloud.
4, 3, 2, 1, time,
called out Major Danby, and raised his eyes triumphantly to discover that no one had been listening to him, and that he would have to begin all over again.
"Oh," he moaned in frustration. "What was that?" roared General Dreidel incredulously,
and whirled around in a murderous rage upon Major Danby, who staggered back in terrified confusion and began to quail and perspire.
"Who is this man?"
Major Danby, sir,"
Colonel Cathcart stammered.
"My group operations officer."
"Take him out and shoot him," ordered General Dreidel.
Sir?
I said take him out and shoot him. Can't you hear?"
"Yes, sir,"
Colonel Cathcart responded smartly, swallowing hard, and turned in a brisk manner to his chauffeur and his meteorologist.
"Take Major Danby out and shoot him."
Sir?
His chauffeur and his meteorologist stammered.
"I said take Major Danby out and shoot him,"
Colonel Cathcart snapped.
"Can't you hear?"
The two young lieutenants nodded lumpishly and gaped at each other in stunned and flaccid reluctance, each waiting for the other to initiate the procedure of taking Major Danby outside and shooting him. Neither had ever taken Major Danby outside and shot him before. They inched their way dubiously toward Major Danby from opposite sides. Major Danby was white with fear. His legs collapsed suddenly, and he began to fall, and the two young lieutenants sprang forward and seized him under both arms to save him from slumping to the floor. Now that they had Major Danby, the rest seemed easy. But there were no guns. Major Danby began to cry. Colonel Cathcart wanted to rush to his side and comfort him, but did not want to look like a sissy in front of General Dreidel. He remembered that Appleby and Havermeyer always brought their .45 automatics on the missions, and he began to scan the rows of men in search of them. As soon as Major Danby began to cry, Colonel Moodus, who had been vacillating wretchedly on the sidelines, could restrain himself no longer and stepped out diffidently toward General Dreidel with a sickly air of self-sacrifice.
I think you'd better wait a minute, Dad," he suggested hesitantly. I don't think you can shoot him."
General Dreidel was infuriated by his intervention.
"Who the hell says I can't?"
he thundered pugnaciously in a voice loud enough to rattle the whole building. Colonel Moodus, his face flushing with embarrassment, bent close to whisper into his ear.
"Why the hell can't I?" General Dreidel bellowed.
Colonel Moodus whispered some more.
"You mean I can't shoot anyone I want to?"
General Dreidel demanded with uncompromising indignation. He pricked up his ears with interest as Colonel Moodus continued whispering.
"Is that a fact?"
he inquired, his rage tamed by curiosity.
Yes, Dad, I'm afraid it is."
"I guess you think you're pretty goddamn smart, don't you?"
General Dreidel lashed out at Colonel Moodus suddenly. Colonel Moodus turned crimson again.
No, Dad, it isn't that...
"All right, let the insubordinate son of a bitch go,"
General Dreidel snarled, turning bitterly away from his son-in-law and barking peevishly at Colonel Cathcart's chauffeur and Colonel Cathcart's meteorologist.
But get him out of this building and keep him out! And let's continue this goddamn briefing before the war ends! I've never seen so much incompetence!
Colonel Cathcart nodded lamely at General Dreidel and signaled his men hurriedly to push Major Danby outside the building. As soon as Major Danby had been pushed outside, though, there was no one to continue the briefing. Everyone gawked at everyone else in oafish surprise. General Dreidel turned purple with rage as nothing happened. Colonel Cathcart had no idea what to do. He was about to begin moaning aloud when Colonel Korn came to the rescue by stepping forward and taking control. Colonel Cathcart sighed with enormous, tearful relief, almost overwhelmed with gratitude.
"Now, men, we're going to synchronize our watches,"
Colonel Korn began promptly in a sharp, commanding manner, rolling his eyes flirtatiously in General Dreidel's direction.
"We're going to synchronize our watches one time and one time only. And if it doesn't come off in that one time, General Dreidel and I are going to want to know why. Is that clear?"
He fluttered his eyes toward General Dreidel again to make sure his plug had registered.
"Now set your watches for 9:18.
Colonel Korn synchronized their watches without a single hitch and moved ahead with confidence. He gave the men the colors of the day and reviewed the weather conditions with an agile, flashy versatility, casting sidelong, simpering looks at General Dreidel every few seconds to draw increased encouragement from the excellent impression he saw he was making. Preening and pruning himself effulgently and strutting vaingloriously about the platform as he picked up momentum, he gave the men the colors of the day again and shifted nimbly into a rousing pep talk on the importance of the bridge at Avignon to the war effort and the obligation of each man on the mission to place love of country above love of life. When his inspiring dissertation was finished, he gave the men the colors of the day still one more time, stressed the angle of approach, and reviewed the weather conditions again. Colonel Korn felt himself at the full height of his powers. He belonged in the spotlight. Comprehension dawned slowly on Colonel Cathcart. When it came, he was struck dumb. His face grew longer and longer as he enviously watched Colonel Korn's treachery continue, and he was almost afraid to listen when General Dreidel moved up beside him and in a whisper blustery enough to be heard throughout the room demanded, "Who is that man?" Colonel Cathcart answered with wan foreboding, and General Dreidel then cupped his hand over his mouth and whispered something that made Colonel Cathcart's face glow with immense joy. Colonel Korn saw and quivered with uncontainable rapture. Had he just been promoted in the field by General Dreidel to full colonel? He could not endure the suspense. With a masterful flourish, he brought the briefing to a close and turned expectantly to receive ardent congratulations from General Dreidel, who was already striding out of the building without a glance backward, trailing his nurse and Colonel Moodus behind him. Colonel Korn was stunned by this disappointing sight, but only for an instant. His eyes found Colonel Cathcart, who was still standing erect in a grinning trance, and he rushed over jubilantly and began pulling on his arm.
"What did he say about me?"
he demanded excitedly in a fervor of proud and blissful anticipation.
"What did General Dreidel say?"
"He wanted to know who you were."
"I know that, I know that. But what did he say about me? What did he say?"
"You make him sick."